And you're listening to your community radio station. It's KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa, K224CQ Molawa'a, and it's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will dig into preparing our site for our most amazing garden yet, and simultaneously shed some light on the no-till method for healthy garden soil. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design, complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Garden Island Hydro, assisting with all your growing needs. Nutrients, mediums, all-natural compost tea, lights, aquaponic and hydroponic components, systems, and setups. In the Puhi Industrial Park, Lihue. Family-owned and operated, open Monday through Saturday, 246-GROW, and online at GardenIslandHydro.com.
And thank you once again to all of our generous underwriters, keeping us on the air, keeping us cultivating this beautiful island community, and cultivating the beautiful soil of this island.
Yeah, and thanks to our listeners, too, who are diehard gardeners. Thanks for taking a break at lunchtime to listen to us, give you some wonderful gardening inspiration and information.
Yes, indeed. And please consider a donation to KKCR. At the KKCR.org webpage, you can find donation links. And once again, we're back in the relative cool of the studio. Thank you so much for everybody who reached out and helped us with our air conditioning fund. It's not too cold. It's just right in here. And we're definitely bristling with excitement about the planting season approaching, the Seed and Plant Exchange, celebrating it coming up this Sunday. And we're just going to jump right in to our feature-packed show, as we do each and every week. Mac is here with us as well, and we're going to be joined by special guest Ken Lindsay, farmer from all parts of the island, really, accumulating lots of experience, and he's going to share some of that with us today. But right now we're going to jump into our celestial session, where we look to the heavenly bodies above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities. And today, which is Wednesday, March 18th, we are celebrating the arrival of the Hawaiian moon Lono. And today's moon phase, brought to us as often by the 2015 Hanalei moon and tide calendar from the Hanalei Watershed Hui and other collaborators, and thanks to the U.S. Naval Observatory Astronomical Application Department for all of the details. Good to know that there's a wing of the military, or at least an office in the military, that's doing some peace work and encouraging us and supporting us even in doing that, healing our relationship with the Earth, too. So, way to go, Navy, on that one. At any rate, Lono rose over Kauai at 5:22 a.m. this morning. She reached her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 11:22 a.m., and she will set at 5:27 p.m., this afternoon, a wafer-thin 3% of the moon's face was illuminated, at least could be seen at sunrise, according to Robin.
Oh, it was just gorgeous. It was about 1 hour before the sun rose, and the sky was just orange with first light, and the glowy sliver of moon just ahead of the sun.
Yeah.
Pretty beautiful.
And this just in advance of the new moon coming up tomorrow night at 11:36 p.m. Lono, one of four major gods, brought to Hawaii from Tahiti. And Lono is the god of agriculture, thunder, rain, and the harvest, amongst many other influences. And the god that brings us the Makahiki season as well. And planting recommendations for today, ipu, gourds, as well as melons. These are both kinolaur, the body of Lono. Other Lono plants, kukui, uala, the sweet potato, ava, amau, and hapu'u, two of the tree ferns of the Hawaiian forest. And speaking of ava, I'm happy to report that last Wednesday, some volunteers, including Bino of Ainaho Community Park, and other friends, harvested three or four beautiful ava plants from both Kauai Mini Golf as well as from the Kalihiwai Community Garden, and we will be serving fresh ava. We cleaned it all up and froze it that night. We'll be serving up that ava at the Seed and Plant Exchange.
Far out.
Yeah, so this Sunday we'll tell you more as the show goes on, but now it's time to look at the biodynamic look at the week.
Sure, there'll be good times all around. Well, this week the moon is in its ascending phase, so the energies have moved to the upper parts of the plant. Today, the moon sits in the constellation of Aquarius, which is an air sign, making it a good time to work with our flowering plants. This, I've said many times on the show, is an excellent time to do cuttings and vegetative propagation. Thursday, tomorrow, the moon's in an unproductive phase, so we get time to do other things that are maybe garden-related and maybe not. Friday, new moon, and Saturday, the moon will be in Pisces, which is a water sign, making it a good time to work with our leaf plants. So we're looking at doing some pruning, perhaps, and in this ascending moon with the also waning moon will result in reduced growth. So also kind of a great time to take the cuttings for the seed exchange on Sunday, Saturday, being that good pruning day in the water sign of Pisces. Uh-huh. Sunday and Monday, the moon will be in Aries, a fire sign, making it time to work with our fruit plants. And that's great news, since there's some fruit plants that will be given away at the seed exchange that if you time it all right, you can get those right in your beautifully prepared beds. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. And I also find it interesting to add that yesterday was technically the spring equinox here in Kauai. I didn't realize this as much as I've studied and learned. You know, like most people who are from the more temperate places, we think March 21st is the equinox, but it was explained to us by our good friend Shaka today that the technical equinox was 12/12 yesterday. So pretty cool. Happy equinox. Lots of equality. Definitely looking for a nice shared, really great shared weekend of fun together this weekend.
Yeah, indeed. While we're on the subject again of the seed exchange, Robin, you've been cultivating some very special plants, as you always do for us. And I was wondering if you could share about some of these fruiting plants that you've been cultivating.
Well, sure, although I'd like to keep most of them a surprise until Sunday.
Okay.
I will.
Don't unwrap too many of those presents.
I'll give one.
Oh, she'll give us one.
Cat out of the bag now, as they say. And I did cultivate a bunch of Principe Borghese tomatoes, which is maybe an under-known variety, but just a stellar variety. It is an Italian tomato. It has a little point at the bottom of the fruit. It is classically the sun-dried tomato that is used. So although it's small like a cherry, has a nice thick skin on it, which protects it from the fruit flies, the flavor is very rich and very meaty. Doesn't kind of explode like a juice bomb in your mouth like a typical cherry tomato. Great for sauces, and I've just found it to be such a hardy plant that will put on multiple fruitings over time. Here in Hawaii, we're always looking for a good tomato. You know, and that's one plant that doesn't seem to grow so easily, and I'm pretty excited to offer a bunch of those.
Yum.
Yeah.
Delightful. And I'm wondering if that is the variety that I've seen Ken grow in the field without a trellis.
Could be.
So we were talking about the Principe Borghese tomato. Is that the one that you've grown in quantity just in a field without any trellising?
Yeah, that one did really well for us. We were pulling them off. It was pretty easy. It was just like hand over fist for a while. Yeah. And just we had probably about like the third generation seed on that one. And I haven't planted it since. So I've definitely been waiting to put that one back in the ground.
Cool. Well, you come to the seed exchange. You can pick one up.
Ken is always with us, and let me give a brief introduction to our good buddy Ken Lindsay, originally from the Windy City. He's been on Kauai for how long now? 8 years?
Over 7 years now. Yep. 7 years in November.
And Ken's farmed on the south side, on the northeast side. He's farming on the North Shore. And Ken is super inspirational to me, young, enthusiastic, and just has that attitude that anything is possible and a lot of the smartest things haven't been tried yet. And he's nodding his head. He's conceding that might be accurate. So that's part of our discussion today, is to dive into no-till, the no-till method, which is not completely unknown here in Hawaii, but certainly hasn't been demonstrated to the extent that we would benefit from. So we're going to jump into that later on. But right now, Robin is going to share a notable newsworthy piece for us.
Yes, I do. And interestingly enough, this does pertain a little bit to no-till, but there's a couple of sides to the story when it comes to no-till, as we'll talk about. But the story is in The Economist, and it's about Brazilian agriculture. Basically, there's been a huge move to farm the desert there. Essentially, they call it the Cerrado, is the desert, and it's being transformed pretty rapidly. It's a pretty large part of the country is the desert, and between 1996 and 2006, large-scale agriculture increased 365% into industrial-sized farms that are focusing on corn, soya, poultry. Ethanol is a byproduct from the corn, and cattle. And so, interestingly enough, most of these crops are GE crops, or genetically modified. And they're plowing it up. They're really doing it to it. As far as the grazing goes, they took some grasses from the African savanna that were, you know, not thriving in drought type conditions there, brought them over to Brazil. Those grasses totally took off in the Brazilian environment, and they were able to start grazing a huge area of the desert. Now, I mean, if you're like me, the first thing that comes to mind is, where are they getting the water for all this? They consider themselves to have it, they call it spare water, but the spare water is probably being diverted away from the rainforests. And so basically taking water from a really wet place and bringing it to somewhere where it doesn't naturally belong. And they're not, a lot of the claims about Brazilian agriculture is that the rainforest is actually being cut down. That's not exactly the case. So much of this farming is happening in the desert, but they are stealing the water from the rainforest, which will have its long-term effects, no doubt. And the main people behind this are the Brazilian Agricultural Research Corporation, which I've learned is a public or government-related business. And they're definitely working on GM soybeans. They just got some more genetically modified seeds approved. And what's interesting to me is, you know, I mean, they've become basically the breadbasket of South America and are now exporting way more. They used to be a huge importer of food. And in the last 15 years or so here, they've been able to grow these industrial farms to the point where they're actually exporting more crops than even the U.S. Midwest. They're growing more GM crops than there. And I don't know why I bring this up is simply that, you know, we want to say that local sustainable agriculture is the solution, although these guys are definitely putting out some food, they're making some food, but what are the long-term repercussions? And so we can't just make sort of cavalier decisions about what we can get in the next year when it may negatively affect our environments for many years to come. But in relation to the no-till, in 2010, from previously 2% of the crops were grown using no-till method, now 50% of the crops are grown using no-till method. And as we will discuss a little bit later in the show about no-till, it can be a really organic process. However, there are industrialized versions where they rely really heavily on herbicides to burn down weed growth in the areas where they're not tilling, and there's certainly plenty of machinery being used, big machinery. And I just thought it was interesting to raise our awareness to where we import our food from. You know, imported food not only uses a lot of fossil fuels just in its travels, but the production of it as well. So really just gearing people more towards a locally based diets.
Indeed. And the more we can grow ourselves and relying on our local farmers, the better off we'll be. Locally adapted plants and seeds and good practices will lead to beautiful produce, as can be seen at our local farmers markets. We want to let people know this is In the Garden on the Farm. We're here until 1 o'clock to talk all manners of growing food and making the land productive and making our lives abundant with food and plants. And so we're going to take another trip to the farmers market. And Robin, once again, has a delicious report for us.
That's right. And, you know, when it comes to local food, I think a big part of the process is us changing our palate, you know, changing what we want to eat and kind of moving, being a little bit experimental and moving more towards trying out some of these tropical foods that are going to grow really well here, as opposed to imported things like so many of the greens and beans that are imported and grown in manners that we're not aware of. But right now at the farmers market, I have to say what I've been noticing, giant piles at the beginning of the market and no piles left at the end of the market, so that's a really great thing for the farmers, is beets. There are a lot of them available now. It's a great growing season for beets. They come in multiple colors and shapes. There's red beets, gold beets, cylindrical beets. And beets contain a unique pigment antioxidants in the root as well as the leaves that have been found to offer protection against coronary artery disease and stroke. And these pigments, all phytonutrients that are the pigments, also lower cholesterol. So really healthy food to be eating. They're low calorie, they're high in fiber and minerals and vitamins and many other phytonutrients. As I said, they're high in folates, although folates are denatured through the cooking process. So juicing or grating onto salad would be a great way to get fresh beets into our diet. The top greens, similar to turnips, we talked about a couple months ago, are actually even more nutritious in a lot of ways than the roots themselves. The top greens are high in vitamin C, vitamin A, and different antioxidants as well. Sauteing the beet tops or steaming them is a really great way to get them in. So when you're at the market and you're looking at beets, you want to look for firm, fresh roots with nice tops on them, because both parts of the vegetable are edible, and I highly recommend trying out some beet greens if you haven't. And also, as we're proponents of organic agriculture all around, I want to say that with root crops, it is particularly important that you want to get organically grown roots, as roots are tend to accumulate different, you know, legacy chemicals and stuff in them. So buy organic.
For sure. And it's making me think about the beet seeds that we sowed out there at the Kanui Kapono Charter School. And I want to give great thanks to Malama Kauai, as well as all the great students there putting in a hand to make that garden happen, and for Ken as well, who gave me some great advice at the last minute on some of the planting suggestions and methods. And it's just a great thing to see that really challenging site bursting with life. Robin, thank you for donating plant material as well. Just a super, and so many other people making a super community contribution to that process. And In the Garden on the Farm is the show. We're going to jump right now into we're sort of rounding out a discussion on starting a new gardening or farming project. We've talked about site assessment and selection. Then we talked about planning a garden. What do you want to grow? And how might you space it out? But now, once these answers have come to you, now it's time to actually get the site ready for growing plants. And another auspicious thing about having Ken in the studio with us today is he has been preparing a new farming project over the past couple of weeks. So when I told him we'd also be talking about site prep, he said, oh, that's what I've been doing every day for the past 2 weeks. So great to have you with the discussion, Ken. And so where shall we begin on this?
Sure. Well, you know, last time we entered the realm of mind gardening. And although that's really fun to do, is to think and talk about the projects, there comes the time when you just got to get down and do the work. And in my little bit of experience of preparing things, I've learned that the building process can be pretty hard on plants. So I would say the first part of site preparation would be to build any structures that need building before any planting is done, so that there's no, you know, nothing's going to get destroyed in the building process. Just speaking from experience there.
And I think that was probably reflected in your project, Ken, when you were already getting your start house, you were getting your nursery situation set up before the tillage actually began.
Yeah, it was, it's nice to have it before you get going, because then you start all your plants that you're going to transplant, but I'm doing mostly direct seeding right now, and I didn't really know the scale that I was going to be at for my transplanting, so deciding on the size of the nursery is really important, because you don't want to overbuild or underbuild, so I kind of waited a little bit to get a good feel of how much I was going to need, and then once I knew that, then I kind of put something together.
Right.
But yeah. Then it changed as soon as I built something, because we needed more space.
Sure, yeah, I've found that too. Whatever space is there, you will fill it. And efficiency in the nursery is really important too. You know, you don't want to be wasting table space in there. Every inch on those tables is really valuable.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because just yesterday I seeded another 11 trays, and I'm already looking for more space now. So I think we've kind of maxed it out, but already I'm using tables that weren't supposed to be used for that. So it's every square inch right now.
Yeah, no doubt. And that, to me, building structures would also include any kind of fencing that needs to be built, whether to deter pigs or chickens from the area. Generally, you know, any kind of cement and type of work, I think, should get done first.
Right. And so that, certainly we see a vast range in terms of the kind of damage that's done by feral animals, or even, you know, it could even be a horse or a cow in the neighborhood that does significant damage. Adam Asquith was speaking to how severe that damage has been in some of the farming operations he's been involved in over the years, and cattle being one of the most significant sort of damagers to crops. So in your situation, Ken, where you've got a pretty big area and a fence is a very significant investment, what sort of thinking about that have you given, or what sort of threats do you find yourself facing?
Well, I'd say a lot of thought in it. When I first started, I never really used fences, and it wasn't a problem. But then after a year on one project, we started getting hit like every night by pigs. So it literally shut us down. So we had to just fence the entire place over like a 3-week period. So then when I left there and went to a new project, I figured, oh, I'll just fence the whole thing right away. It'll be easy to get it done first before you start plowing the ground, because you don't want it to be in the way. And then a pig never showed up. So we kind of, it wasn't really necessary. And when you put in a fence, it's a lot of extra work too once it's in, because then you have to maintain all the edges, like all the weed whacking and mowing, and that gets to be a lot of work. So right now, I just figured I'd go without a fence until I see some damage, which is really risky. But you can kind of get the feel of the neighborhood to see like who gets hit and with what, because a lot of times they go for certain, like pigs go for certain crops. You know, like mostly like root crops. I've never really seen them damage anything other than that, unless it's, you know, collateral damage on their way to eating something like that. And then chickens are another big one, and those are almost impossible to fence out because they'll just fly right in. So it takes constant just being out there and, you know, taking a few out or trapping if you have to. I've done tons of trapping, and, you know, sometimes you have to shoot a couple of the really trouble ones. But my biggest problem right now, which I never thought I'd ever have a problem with, is a pheasant.
They're hungry,
we
man.
We lost three rows of sweet corn and a whole row of beans to them in like a day, and I've never seen that problem before. So as soon as you let your guard down, something new can come up too, you know. There's, yeah, a bunch of things that can get you, but it just comes down to being out there all the time and just watching it and monitoring and then taking action when you need to. Right. But if someone says, hey, there's tons of pigs around here, you should probably put a fence in right away.
Right on, good advice there.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, in addition to our preparations, we're also thinking about our irrigation early on, kind of a construction project, really. Oftentimes, heavy machinery brought into the area, creating soil compaction, and certainly we don't want to be undoing any of the soil work that we will wind up doing our soil preparation. So some pretty significant heavy equipment work happening out in your neck of the woods as well, Ken. 80-foot eucalyptus trees coming down.
Oh yeah,
pretty dramatic view next year, sort of dwarfing the size of what is otherwise a pretty big field, but boy, those trees laying in the field sure make everything look small by comparison to them.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's one that's still pretty close to your spot.
Yeah, it should be able to fall where it won't damage anything, though, so I feel pretty good about it.
Yeah, certainly want to get any of those big trees that will shade or give competition or even allelopathic type, you know, effects on our garden. You want to get those out of there right away, early on. But yeah, irrigation is ultimately like laying down hard line, deciding what systems, and we are going to have a very detailed irrigation discussion in a month or so, right, Paul? Somewhere in there.
We will. But we should let people know too that if the plan is to use county irrigation, that there is a tremendously expensive for a small gardener or small farming operation to have a backflow preventer. Important so that the agricultural water doesn't flow back into the system and contaminate the drinking supply, but water meter plus a backflow preventer is a significant investment and shouldn't be overlooked when the budget of a project is being considered.
Sure, but lining out your systems, you know, a line to the greenhouse, a couple lines, however much pressure you can decide each area of gardening is going to take, and you just want to make sure you have plenty of water flow to water the crops that you plan to grow there.
Cool. Okay, so moving on with our site preparation, we're going to consider planting some long-term, maybe perennial, maybe we're putting in our windrow at this point, and maybe some of our fruit trees.
That's right, windrows and fruit trees. I'm a proponent of get those suckers in the ground soon so they can be on the grow and be giving fruits. You know, it might take you a little longer to refine the garden beds, but, you know, get those fruit trees on the grow as soon as possible.
Now, Ken, in your area, you have some really big wind breaks, but I'm wondering if you're considering smaller wind breaks within the large field that you find yourself in. Do you think it's going to be important?
Oh, yeah. Like, as soon as I get most of the ground opened up, then I'll probably end up putting in a lot of pigeon pea. I found that to be really successful in Moloa, just putting in rows like every – I was experimenting with between 25 and 50 feet. 25 seems a bit excessive. And then 50 seems to be about right, because otherwise it just takes up a little bit too much field space. There's a little bit too much shading.
Uh-huh.
And then you also end up pruning twice as much because you have to cut all that back too. You don't want to have like full size pigeon peas.
Right.
And then also just working with like quick growing grasses, but that's more experimental right now. I feel really comfortable with pigeon pea. It's a really easy plant to get to grow quick that'll provide a really good windbreak function.
It does. It's a superstar. You know, you're basically growing your own fertilizer, too. I mean, those clippings are great for adding into the compost or dropping around your fruit trees. Plus, there's a food crop available there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really easy to grow. You can get tons of seed for them. And I found, like, a 2 to 4 foot spacing is usually best. Mm. 4 is probably a little better, but 2 is really nice, too. 2 makes a really beautiful hedge, and seems like a little too close, but that seems to be my favorite right now.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when you design a windbreak, you want to make sure that you can let some wind through and get it all the way around. You don't want to just leave strips, otherwise you can get hit when you're not expecting it.
Sure. Well, that's the thing about wind, right? It's friend and foe. Mm-hmm. You know, with no airflow in the field, you end up with, you know, pest problems, basically. But with too much, your plants can kind of take a hit. And I was so proud of the butterhead lettuces over the winter because we had some pretty windy storms, and they laid so flat to the ground. The butterheads were so low that the wind just couldn't touch them. It was pretty amazing. So we also can plan our gardens such that, you know, the windier areas contain plants that are a little more tolerant to that sort of thing.
Oh, and one thing I found too in Moloa was it really helps reduce the evaporation because it's such a hot, dry place already. When you have wind just whipping through the field, it'll carry away so much more water. Once you have like a nice little protected zone, it seems like the plants are just, they're not happier just because of the lack of stress from the wind itself. But you start losing less water through the air. You know, that makes a big difference.
It does. The wind can really desiccate things.
Truly. And we were mentioning pigeon peas before. I know a lot of people have been propagating pigeon peas for the seed exchange. It seems like every other person is bringing some pigeon peas. So if you need more for your project, you have never tried pigeon peas, come to the Seed and Plant Exchange this Sunday. And it's fun to reflect on the pigeon pea that we consider our signature one that, thanks to Ken planting a pigeon pea hedge at a 2 foot spacing, I believe it was, around one of the gardens at the Kauai Community College some years back, there was a single plant that had the super speckle to it.
The super speckle, I remember
it. So we had a nice yield of those, and we'll have both plants and seed. And I'm going to show you guys after the show the next signature variety has popped out of our field. We have the black speckle, which is just a spontaneous different one that's come about. Again, a highly challenged plant in the field like the super speckled was, just not in the right spot, it doesn't seem, but it's got this beautiful black speckled pea to it. So that'll have to be the fall seed exchange because we've got to grow it out now, but we'll have plenty of pigeon pea of other varieties there this weekend. So moving on in our site preparation, we've got our irrigation in. We've planted our fruit trees to give them a good head start, and we're going to be thinking about building our soil. And depending on where you are, but if you're in the Hawaiian Islands, there's probably some there's a lot of considerations. And we've been fortunate up at Waikoa to have Sun and Rich, Ken, and other knowledgeable people advising them from soil testing standpoint on what sort of minerals need to be added back into tired soil that's been farmed for many years. And Ken, I know you've been looking at some different soil testing houses, and what's the latest report on that?
It's pretty much down to two. It seems like those are the ones that most people go with, is A&L Labs and then Kinsey Labs. Neil Kinsey has a hands-on agronomy book and video, and that's really changed the way I farm because it really allows you to dial it in. It's not just putting in what's not there. It's putting it in the right ratios to each other. That really makes a big difference because it could be in there, but if you have too much of one thing, it might block one thing or another from being taken up, and there's a lot of places to go wrong. And then also putting in all the micronutrients, too. That's something that I was really never on, but I feel like that makes a big difference, not just for the plants, but, you know, for your own health, too, as far as what you're eating after your plant takes it up.
Yes. Yeah, we want nutrient dense. So I've been using C90. I don't know if you've tried that at all. That's basically ocean water that's been, the sodium has been removed, but all of the other minerals are there, and it looks like a salt. It is a salt. Certainly sends the electrical charge of the soil, like, right through the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And, gosh, I've never had such beautiful colors in my vegetables. Like, the red lettuce is so red. Mm-hmm. This is me, too. I was a little lax on the micronutrients, but I've definitely changed my tune and see that it's just the plants are really much healthier. And I've heard so many people say it, and it's so easy to roll my eyes at it, but without a healthy, if the plant isn't healthy, it's not, if it's not in healthy soil, it can't be healthy, and it is going to be the pest magnet. It's going to be the plant that the pests charge towards. So keeping our optimal nutrition for our soil and our plants, and then inadvertently ourselves as well, once we start munching down on it.
Yeah. So one of the considerations, too, not only what we're putting in the soil, but how we are choosing to cultivate it. We're going to be talking about no-till in just a little while, but tillage is something that is commonly used. And in many cases, I would say, even with the no-till method, you got to till perhaps at least one time if you want to add some of the nutrients to it to a deeper level. And I had thought that you kind of, it's beneficial to till as deep as you can go, depending on what kind of equipment you can get a hold of, is a good thing because of the increased drainage. But I'm learning that there's more considerations to that. And I'm thinking, Ken, you did not rip your field when you first planted. Is that correct?
No, this is the first time we haven't ripped. That was kind of always the go-to implement. Like, rip it as deep as you can was the thinking, and then till it, you know, so you got, like, a nice smooth planting material to, you know, plant into. And this is the first time that I started using a plow, and it doesn't go nearly as deep. But at the same time, I don't know how important that is. So right now, what I'm doing in my field is a quarter acre is going to be plowed, and then the other quarter acre is going to be ripped. One thing that is kind of guiding my decisions too is it seems like it may be more expensive when you rip, because then you need to apply more amendments because you're amending more soil when you go deeper. So I've seen crops that have been just grown after plowing, and I thought they looked great. So right now in my field, the plowed field, everything looks great too. So I just, when I put it on paper and seeing how much it would cost, you know, theoretically, between ripping and plowing, it's a big difference, you know, depending on how deep you go. So I feel like I'm satisfied with the plowing, and if you don't have to disturb the soil that much, you know, maybe you shouldn't. But again, this, I'm still in the experimental stage on that one.
Sure. Well, but I'm embarrassed, but I'd like to ask, because I'm a very small scale gardener. Mm-hmm. But what is exactly the difference between a ripper and a plow?
A ripper is just a big iron shanks, more or less, on the back of a really powerful tractor that go down deep into the soil and loosen
teeth.
It up.
They're like teeth that go in?
Yeah, imagine like a, just a, maybe like a 2 to 3 foot piece of iron with kind of a foot on the end. You
mm-hmm.
know, and then it just you lower it into the soil and just gets dragged through the soil and just breaks up everything. And then usually you do that one way and then go back the other way to like mm-hmm. cross strip the field. And then with a plow, all it does is it just pretty much slices the soil and then just flips it over on itself. So uh-huh. then you do the same thing. You can plow it once, and then you can double plow it and cross plow. Mm-hmm. And that way, it seems like you can get down maybe about 6-8 inches or so, mm-hmm. depending on the soil, you know.
Of course.
And after being in Kalihiwai now and being in Moab before, I don't know how effective a plow would be out there just because it's a different soil type. It seems like that may play a big part in it too. You know, it's just where you're at. It may be appropriate to use a different method depending on, you know, where you're farming.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, thank you.
And how was the timing for you in terms of the moisture of the soil and your considerations of not too wet, not too dry?
It's been perfect. Usually, I really want to do a lot of the soil work in the summertime just because it's drier and you don't want to work the soil when it's really wet. That's like the worst thing you can do. Again, you don't want it to be dusty either, but you can put down water if you want to. You can't remove it when you want to. So it's been nice in a way that it's been kind of a drier winter, because I feel like the soil work's just been gone off without a hitch. You know, I was kind of nervous to start opening up large pieces of land this time of year, because that can really influence your weed growth too. If you open up a field and you get a ton of rain, then, you know, weeds sprout back really hard. But if you don't get any rain, stays dry, a lot of your perennial, like the grasses and sedges, they won't grow back as vigorously, and then you won't get a lot of the annual sprouting either. So then you can kind of control the weed growth through your irrigation, you know. But I feel like the soil has been perfect for working with, so it's been really lucky, you know, because you could be, I've been on the other end of that too, you know. We have to wait weeks, a month before you can get in there and do anything.
Right on. So we're speaking with Ken Lindsay. He's an organic farmer here on the north shore of Kauai. And we're here until 1 o'clock. We want to encourage you to stay tuned to KKCR. We've got a lot of great programming each and every Wednesday and all throughout the week. Kauai Vibrations from 1 to 3 today. And the Papule Show from 3 to 5. Kauai Surf Stories after that. And lots of great programming finishing off in the 10 to 12 slot, actually, with Ellie, who works at Aninaho Community Park. And they're hosting the Kauai Community Seed and Plant Exchange coming up this Sunday, March 22nd, noon to 5. More information at ribg.org. And hope to see you there. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah, well, jumping back into the site preparation, I'd say it's kind of a timing thing, and certainly the weather plays into it, but somewhere in the process of building your soil, you also want to start thinking about planting seeds for transplant or collecting other plant material if there's things you'll be planting that are vegetatively propagated, kind of getting those things on the grow so that once you build the soil, you get some amendments in there, it has a little time to sort of mellow in the soil. Yeah, do you practice that, Ken, of putting in your amendments and kind of letting the field sit a little bit?
Yes and no. Like this time I was really anxious to get planting, and I really wanted to see what would happen, you know, between planting, you know, sooner than later.
Mm-hmm.
And everything still looks pretty good, but I feel like another week or two might have been beneficial, and almost not just for like the soil chemistry part of it, but just for the amount of, you know, like the coarse organic matter that's left after you, you know, change a field from being whatever it was into what you want it to be. Because that made just a lot of the seeding a lot more difficult. And it just seems like the crops in the first two beds weren't as good as the succeeding ones or after that, you know.
Sure.
But it could be, you know, the soil chemistry could be a part of it too. And there's some, you know, some pest damage too, like some cutworms. So it's really hard to tease out the effects of what you're doing. You know, it takes,
yes,
you know, week after week and really looking at everything that's going on to really see like a clear pattern of what's happening.
Absolutely. You can't tell much in just 1 week. It's got to be a succession of long term. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, when it comes to building soil, you know, we want to talk about adding compost to the soil. And I mean, I know I started making my own at home for my small system, but how are you approaching the compost scene at your farm?
I'd say compost gets to be hard to work with at a certain scale,
mm-hmm,
just because it's hard to make that much or to buy that much and then to apply that much. So one way that you can get around that, or that I'm working with now, is just use, you know, compost tea. It's a way to like take something, mm-hmm, that's kind of a precious material and have like the largest effect on your field. You're just really inoculating it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use it as a drench, or, you know, spray it on the leaves as a foliar. And that's the only way that I could see right now that I could either afford or that I'd have the time to do. Like if I had machinery all the time and I could keep flipping piles, it still might be difficult just because you need to collect all the material and the right kind of material and really be on it, you know. Otherwise, your compost cannot be as good as you'd want it to be.
Yeah.
And yet you are growing cover crops and you will be composting those in the field, yes?
Yeah, that's kind of the way that I'm looking at trying to do composting on a large scale in a way. It's kind of like just a large scale cold compost. Like that's how I see it, you know. It could be completely terming it the wrong way, but it's a way to keep the biology in your field all the time, you know. Like instead of just like concentrating all that biomass and cooking it down into something, you're just doing it in the field and not having to mess with it as much, you know. I mean, it's definitely a different thing, you know. Like composting is great, and on a small scale it's awesome, you know. But, and then if you could do it on a large scale too, I'm sure plenty of guys do it on a large scale. It's just in my farming, I'm not there yet, you know. I would like to be able to do it.
Yeah, it's time consuming, mm-hmm, and labor intensive to build compost in one spot and then haul it and then make really quality compost and then haul it all to the field. And that's something that our friend Amigo Bob really taught me, was composting in place with cover crops, basically. Mm-hmm. And so when I chop down the cover crop, I've been having great success using the LAB, or lactic acid bacteria, the natural farming preparation. And it's kind of all ones in one smooth move, is chop it down, inoculate it with LAB, and turn it under. And I was amazed at how quickly the LAB helped that cover crop just melt down to nothing. I mean, it really took about a week, maybe 10 days, and there was no visible residue of the cover crop I had just turned
in. Which was what in that case?
It was buckwheat, cowpeas, and mustard all mixed together. Hmm. So I was amazed at how it improved the quality of my soil, just one round of cover cropping. So if you get into the system, I think it can work really well. And that's actually a pretty great segue into the no-till method. So we'll kind of switch gears here a little bit and head towards Secrets of the Soil Builders. And we want to talk about the no-till method today. And there's lots of different methodology. It's not something I've used at all, so part of why we invited you here today, Ken, so you can kind of lead the discussion for us about no-till, what got you interested in it, how successful it's been for you, and maybe some of your current experiments in that direction.
Yeah, I think experiment is the key word. You know, that's like with everything in farming. I don't have a solid way that I farm. It's constantly changing and evolving, and you know, you're always gonna have the fundamental things, you know, that you're always gonna carry over. But you know, I mean, today when I planted, I changed. You know, so it's like, it's, you have to constantly be adapting, I feel mm-hmm. like, you know. And then when you find the things that are super successful, you know, of course you're going to keep those, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I think the main thing that comes down to no-till farming is that if it's done right, it ends up just being less energy used, you know. Not just your own energy, it's tractor fuel, you know, everything that you're doing, you're kind of doing it in one fell swoop, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you're disturbing the soil less, so you can kind of build the way I see it is build more of a mature soil ecosystem. You know, if you're in there constantly tearing things up and disturbing things, it's going to be hard for things to really, you know, develop a really tight community, you know. So, but there's a ton of practical challenges with it too. So the foundation of a no-till system is cover cropping, and using that cover crop as a mulch, you know. I think almost everyone could agree that mulching's a good thing to do. But it's the same thing with compost. How do you do it on a large scale? Because practically, it's too time-consuming. You know, you couldn't really do it. And then where are you going to get all that material? I've done that in Moloa, where we put down, I think it was 600 yards of mulch in an acre. It was a program through the NRCS, and that worked great. Like, that literally changed how I farmed for a long time, you know. But we were in a different situation there, and it is more time-consuming up front. But then what you gain in the weed control, and, you know, your soil's eating that, essentially, and moisture control, you know, you're saving a lot by doing that up front. But then how do you do it on a large scale without having to out there wheelbarrow by wheelbarrow, or, you know, bucket by bucket with a machine, get it onto the field? Mm-hmm. So essentially, the best book that I could probably recommend, it's how you would do it, like, on the largest scale, would be I think it's No-Till Farming by Jeff Moyer from Rodale Institute. And that's just such a perfect, concise book about how you would do this on a large scale. So, I mean, just imagine you go out, do your normal field prep, and then instead of planting, you plant your cover crop, just say Sudex or like a large grass, just for example. You can use anything. Well, not anything, but you have to use the right cover crop for the right situation. That's like a big part of it, is choosing the right cover crop and then managing it correctly, because there's a lot of ways you can go wrong. And then what they use is a tool called a roller crimper that goes on the front of a tractor, and you're pretty much just more or less steamrolling it, but you're not just bending it over, you're crinkling it crimping it at the bottom, so that it actually kills the plant. So now you're like killing the plant. It's laid down flat as a mulch, and then they put a planter or like a seeder on the back of it, and then they just plant right through that. So now you've, in one swoop, you know, you've taken down your cover crop, you've mulched, and now you've planted behind it. You know, that's the overall concept of it, you know.
Yeah, I witnessed a roller crimper. Extension Service, or CTAR, has a paper out written by Kunhui Wang, who was one of our guests a while ago too, and I got to see what the roller crimper looks like. And it is, and you can actually fill it with water. The only question I had about it was, isn't that heavy? Doesn't that kind of lean towards compacting the soil?
That's a good question. Yeah.
That was the only thing that stuck out in my mind.
They don't mention that it's a problem in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they get around alleviating the compaction through the aggressive root action of the cover cropping.
Sure.
You know, maybe that's enough to keep the balance. And I think that it's more practiced, not in the, you know, subtropics or the tropics. It's more of like a temperate. I haven't seen an example of it really done that way in the tropics. I haven't researched it a bunch. But it seems like you plant your cover crop one time, and then in the beginning of the year, then you roll that down, you plant into it, and then you're only doing it once, you know? So
right.
I think maybe just since it's a once-a-year thing, it doesn't compact the soil as much. That would, you know, that's my thought.
Sure, probably a little different here in the tropics, mm-hmm. where we can go through several cycles in a year.
Yeah.
And, well, Lord knows that probably the original text, the history of no-till is, as old as man, I would think, because way back, no-till method was pretty much like throw the stick in the ground and make a hole and drop your seed in there to grow, right? That's a no-till gardening. Now, granted, we've come a long way from there, but Matsunobu Fukuoka wrote One Straw Revolution, which was basically well into the industrial agriculture time frame, but he wanted to just do something different. And I would recommend to our listeners that that's a good read for backyard people who want to create small systems. But tell me the name of the book, No-Till.
I think it's just No-Till Farming.
No-Till Farming by
Jeff Moyer.
Jeff Moyer. Yeah. That's a good one for people to check out, too.
Yeah, and when you compare, really, Fukuoka's method with that, it's not that dissimilar.
Sure.
You know, he's growing just two crops, you know, he's not like doing veggie farming in that system, you know.
Right.
But it's just, you know, harvest your grain, cut the stalks and put them back in whole pieces back on the ground, you
mm-hmm.
know, and you're just doing that between rice and I think it's barley. And
right.
It's really, you know, it's pretty much the same thing. You're just growing a crop. In this sense, it's not a cover crop, it's a food crop. Then you're just returning that material back to the field as mulch.
Sure. And in this way, the mycorrhiza and other funguses that make friends with the plant roots don't ever get disturbed. They get to just be right there ready for the next seedling
mm-hmm.
root system to move in, and they can just jump right onto that.
Definitely. And another book I would just want to recommend for backyard too it's another Rodale book, is Ruth Stout. There's a couple books that she wrote, and that's another great smaller scale backyard kind of approach to no-till farming. And again, it's all pretty much based on mulch. You know, she's just aggressive mulcher with hay. And
mm-hmm.
but it's, you know, throwing down a thick enough layer, you're going to suppress weeds, and then all those other good things happen.
Wow. And so you have actually been doing this on a small scale, some experimentation, and pretty pleased with the results so far?
Yeah, it's, you know, usually when in experimenting, if it doesn't work, you just toss it out. But the more and more I do it, I find it just works better and better, you know. So now it's just finding the most efficient ways to do it where we live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm working with right now. And at a small scale, it works good, too, because if you're just working with a quarter acre, you don't need to have a big roller crimper to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can just get, they actually mentioned in the book, like a piece of angle iron.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just go and just walk down the row and just, you know, smash it by foot. You know, it's just a piece of iron two pieces of rope that are in your hand. And you just walk down the row and smash it. So that's what I'm going to be doing real soon, as soon as my cover crop gets big enough.
Yeah.
And then that'll be fun to see what the results of that are, you know. That's going to really be like, it's going to make it or break it for me. It's like, is this really that effective? And if so, then where do you go from there? It seems like right now it's all about perennial weed control. If I went in and did this right now without pulling out all the grasses that grow back and, you know, the nut sedge and controlling a lot of the big flush of the annual weeds, I feel like it'd be a failure. You know, and they even say that in the book, like, that's, you need to have your weed management under control before you can really do it. So it's really pitched as more of a transitional strategy as, mm-hmm. hey, just, you know, just go out and do it. It says, it takes a lot of work to really figure out the right combinations. And on the mainland, it's even harder because if you miss that window of cover cropping or if you don't have your, you know, rain when you need it, it could be a bust for the year and then you can't do it.
Right. Wow. Well, very inspiring. And Ken, it's just so great that you're doing these practices, you're thinking outside the box, and I think you're going to be inspiring a whole new generation of farmers here on Kauai with some of your innovations. And thanks for continuing to be my teacher.
Yeah.
And just great to, you know, find a better way. That's what we need in everything these days.
Yeah. I mean, the best thing you could do to figure it out is fail. You know, just fail, and then you'll figure something out.
Right on.
Whether it's what you want to keep doing or what you don't want to do. So that's, you know, that's the best advice I can give on it, is just keep trying different things and find what works for you.
Awesome.
Yeah, well, big admiration to you. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to your great produce at the market again soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, harvesting arugula tonight. Be the first food out of my new plot.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah. Very
Thanks.
Exciting. So just a few minutes left to give a couple of announcements for the coming weekend. And coming up classes, there is a bee class starting up this week. In fact, it's just a one-day class, honey harvesting and wax processing class. With Jimmy Trujillo at the Kauai Community College, haven't checked to see if the class is full. It often does, so you might want to give them a call sooner rather than later to find out availability. 245-8318 is the number. There's also a hive split and swarm recovery class coming up as well, starting on March 28th, and also happening April 4th with the same number, 245-8318, at the Office of Continuing Education. The 15th Biannual Kauai Community Seed and Plant Exchange is going to be held this Sunday, March 22nd, from noon to 5 p.m. at the Ininaho Community Park in Kilauea. That's the home of Kauai Mini Golf and our beloved Namahana Farmers Market as well. Diane Ragoni of the Breadfruit Institute is going to be our featured speaker. There'll be lots of great local food, music, prizes, just a whole lot of fun. Bring your GMO-free, pest-free, non-invasive seeds, plants, and cuttings to share. For more information, you can go to ribg.org or call 652-4118. We also want to let you know that there's a Plants of the Society Islands Art Exhibition starting up this Saturday, March 21st at the National Tropical Botanical Gardens Botanical Research Center in Kalaheo. Worth going just to see this amazing building they put together about 4 or 5 years ago. The first LEED certified building on the island of Kauai, and housing the incredible library and herbarium of the National Tropical Botanical Garden, as well as their science department. So this specific art exhibition features extraordinary prints from Joseph Banks' trip to the Pacific Islands in the 1700s, and these beautiful engraved plates were made, and then it wasn't until 200 years later that they actually made prints from the plates. So really amazing history and stories, and the beauty of the plates themselves. For more information about this art exhibition, which opens this Saturday, March 21st, and continues through the 22nd of May, you can go to ntbg.org/art. For more information. And this has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Robin and Paul. We want to thank our special guest in studio, Ken Lindsay.